brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's battle report time, but not just any battle report. This is a battle report from White Dwarf issue 166 from October 1993. This was my very first White Dwarf, and coincidentally it was the release of Warhammer 40k 2nd edition. So they had a battle report, an introductory battle report, between Andy Chambers and Jervis Johnson. So I initially, for some reason or another, decided to read this battle report in its entirety for my Patreon account, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Patreon. Most people don't click the link and most people don't support it. It's not a very good Patreon. I don't do very much bonus content there at all. This was one of the rare instances of some bonus content. But yeah, that was last year. So I think it's fine if we put this out in the feed and let everyone enjoy it. Maybe not so much the narrator, but certainly the content itself. Here it is. Next month sees the release of the brand new Warhammer 40,000. What better way to demonstrate the new system in action than to publish a report of an epic game played recently at the studios between two old adversaries, Jervis Johnson and Andy Chambers. As might be expected, the game turned out to be a bitter and close-fought contest between these two superb generals, with the result hanging in the balance until the final dice roll of the very last turn. Introduction. The revised and updated edition of Warhammer 40,000 has been under preparation here at the studio for some considerable time. Now that it's all set to storm into the shops, we thought it'd be good to have a battle report in White Dwarf using the new rules just to demonstrate what an even more exciting game it's become. We played this game on one of our 8x4 tables here at the studio and kept notes of moves and casualties as we went for later reference when writing up the conflict. Due to the difficulties of taking decent photos of a game in progress, we took Polaroids of the action and reshot the pictures for this article sometime later with proper lighting and cameras. This technique allows us to have an uninterrupted game and still get the best photos. Warhammer 40,000 now includes an integrated victory system, which owes not a little to Space Marine and Warhammer Battle. Both players score victory points for destroying enemy vehicles and wiping out opposing squads. In addition, both players draw a mission card at the beginning of the game. The mission cards give you ways of scoring bonus victory points by, for example, seizing an objective or killing the enemy commander. The battle is played for a preset number of turns, usually 4, and the end of the game player with the most victory points is the winner. Jervis and I agreed to choose our forces and set up the terrain before we randomly drew our mission cards. This way our forces would have to be well balanced to cover all eventualities, rather than having the luxury of an optimal combination of forces for the terrain and the mission. Once we'd picked our forces, Jervis set up the terrain and we played the game over the course of an afternoon. Most people have their own favourite way of setting up terrain. One of the most common is for one player to set up the terrain and for the other person to choose which table edge he wants to deploy on, which is what we did here. When we revised Warhammer 40,000, we attempted to cover areas of the rules that hadn't been previously included. Terrain setup, for example, was one of the areas that was conspicuously lacking in the original rules, and the new rules do include a system that allows both players to participate. Likewise, there were no hard and fast rules for deployment in the original Warhammer 40,000, but this area is now probably one of the most important parts of the game. As explained later, in the new Warhammer 40,000, forces are allotted a strategy rating. This dictates who deploys first and saves the bother of having to draw up maps or erect a screen across the table. Troops are allowed to deploy up to 24 inches apart from each other, but not within 12 inches of the table edges. This means you don't end up in opposite corners, but should start close enough to get stuck in right away. The fact that one player gets to see the other player's deployment before placing his own troops on the table is an immensely powerful weapon, as this battle will hopefully demonstrate. The Blood Angels Battle Plan by Andy Chambers. Aha! Once again, an opportunity has arisen for me to unleash the most excellent Blood Angels against my old adversary, Orc Warlord Johnson. In testing out all the races using the new Warhammer 40,000 rules, we've found that one of the stickiest prospects is Space Marines versus Orcs. The overwhelming numbers of the Orcish Horde seem unstoppable, with two Orcs springing forward to take the place of everyone you gun down. Added to this, their heavy weapons and vehicles are cheap too. Because Space Marines are much harder now, their points values have gone up to the point where you could expect to be outnumbered by at least 2 or 3 to 1. Of course, the indomitable Space Marines are more than a match for paltry Orcish scum, with their Space Marine power armour with a plus 3 saving throw, excellent accuracy and close combat skills, plus their rapid fire ability — Space Marines could now fire twice if they don't move — and superb morale. Rather than breaking and fleeing when they fail a leadership test, like other troops, Space Marines merely become shaken and unable to advance on the enemy. Perhaps the most telling advantage the Space Marines possess is their high strategy rating, which allows them to set up second and, if they're reasonably lucky, move first too. This would be my best defence against the numerical superiority of the Orcs, because I would be able to set up most of my forces to engage only part of the Orc Horde. We decided to play our game with 1500 points aside, so I could only really afford 3 or 4 squads of Space Marines plus some support. The first thing I sorted out was my Space Marine commander, Brother Captain Erasimus Tycho, weighing in at a hefty 90 points. At this stage, I was content to equip him with a humble bolt gun and move on with the hope of returning to buy him some Wargear cards later. I skipped picking any more characters until I had selected my squads. I didn't know which mission card I would draw for the game, so I tried to choose a selection of squads that would cover most eventualities. First choice was one of the ubiquitous and quite excellent Space Marine tactical squads. This would give me a flexible unit that would be able to push forward against the Orcs or hold their ground with equal ability. Space Marine squads are unusual in that they are, by tradition, selected as 10-man units and then broken down into 2 5-man combat squads for deployment. I broke the tactical squad down into Squad Polis with a flamer and Squad Mephisto with a missile launcher. This is my usual preference for squad splitting. The flamer squad operates up front with the missile launcher squad close behind to give heavier support as necessary. As an additional refinement, I bought Sergeant Polis a chainsword and placed him with the flamer squad to give it a little more bite in hand-to-hand combat. The tactical squad with missile launcher, flamer and chainsword came to 354 points. Added to the cost of Brother Captain Tycho, this brought my total so far to 447 points. The second squad I selected was a Blood Angels Space Marine Devastator squad. A Devastator squad trades off the flexibility of the tactical squad for the brute firepower of 4 heavy weapons. This particular squad included a missile launcher, las cannon, heavy bolter and a heavy plasma gun. Ordinarily, I would split a Devastator squad down into 1 combat squad, including all of the heavy weapons, plus the sergeant, and another combat squad comprising the remaining Space Marines armed with bolt guns. For this battle, however, I wanted to spread the heavy weapons around a little bit more for extra flexibility. To this end, I formed Squad Adorno, including the Heavy Bolter and Heavy Plasma Gun, while Squad Ariosto included the Las Cannon and Missile Launcher. This placed both of the medium and long-ranged weapons together in different squads and gave each squad a weapon for gunning down troops and a weapon for destroying vehicles. I also bought Sergeant Adorno a Power Fist to supplement his squad's close assault abilities. The Devastator squad with its 4 heavy weapons and power glove cost 455 points, bringing my running points total to 902. I was torn between another tactical squad or something a bit more offensive for my third and final squad. Though I was tempted by a close assault squad, I could foresee it being swallowed up whole by the Orcish Horde, so in the end I decided on something which could fight at a distance against a far superior number of enemy troops, a Terminator squad. Terminator squads don't come cheap. 5 Terminators cost more than 10 ordinary Space Marines. Their storm bolters and tactical dreadnought armour make them more than a match for anyone in a shootout. The biggest problem with using Terminators is getting them into action quickly. Every missed opportunity to fire means all those points you've spent on them are effectively wasted. To ensure a quick, clean deployment of the Terminators, I bought them a Rhino APC to drop them right where I wanted them to go. This would free them up on later turns to get into cover instead of having to worry about advancing. This trick of using a Rhino to deploy Terminators is something I've learned from Jervis to my cost. The Terminator's Redemptor squad cost 420 points, including the Rhino and an assault cannon as the squad heavy weapon. Added to the run in total, this brought me to 1,322 points, leaving me less than 200 points. With my squad sorted out, what I really needed to round out my force was some decent support, something that could dish out a lot of damage and survive plenty of fire itself. We've just had one of the monstrous new Space Marine dreadnoughts painted up, and I knew it would fulfil both these criteria admirably. The cost for this was another 200 points, including the upgrade of one arm to a multi-melter and the addition of a bank of auto-launchers armed with frag grenades. Unfortunately, this would take me over my 1500 point limit, but Jervis agreed to up the value of his force to compensate. Thus, my force was chosen. Though with only one character and no additional war gear for him, I was fundamentally lacking in this area. However, in view of the fact that I had a mere 25 Space Marines to face the Orcs with, I was unwilling to sacrifice any more troops or the Dreadnought to gain more characters. Still, I could take solace in the thought that my ordinary Space Marines were as good as Orc knobs anyway. Jervis had already set up the terrain for the battle, so all that remained was to draw our mission cards randomly and prepare our deployment. Deployment and mission cards. I drew the Dawn Raid mission card, which meant I would have to forge across the battle zone and get either an undamaged vehicle or a squad with less than 50% casualties into Jervis's deployment zone by the end of the game. This would be a tall order indeed. I reckoned that with the dreadnoughts around to support my advance, I could punch through the orcs. The trick would be to avoid any advancing squads being encircled and cut off. Jervis drew the assassins, which meant that he would be out to kill or injure brother Captain Tycho, and he didn't even have a refractor field to protect him. This was fortunate for me because the orcs would have been much better off trying to swarm past me on a dawn raid of their own or sitting back and gunning me down on an engage and destroy mission. At least I could try to keep brother Captain Tycho out of harm's way. The battlefield presented me with some immediate problems. After looking over it for a while, I chose the edge with the bunkers and slightly more open layout in its deployment zone. This side of the table seemed to offer good positions for my devastators and offered a better route through to the opposite edge of the table by using the jungles on my left. The bunkers on the right looked tempting as a good strong point to hold, but I knew from previous experience that the broad swathe of clear terrain in front of them would offer an ideal place for the orcs to deploy in strength and bring their numbers to bear. Anything placed in the bunkers would die. As Jervis started to deploy his forces, I tried to formulate a plan of action. The bunkers were a death trap, and anything on the right-hand side would have to bear the full brunt of the orcs' numbers. The jungles, on the other hand, were so tightly grouped that numbers would probably be of little benefit in them, except if hand-to-hand combat occurred. My dreadnought would obviously be better off in the jungles, sheltered from most of the orcs' heavy weapons by the lush green canopy. The Dreadnought would be accompanied by Squad Pollis and Squad Mephisto, and this joint assault group would try to blast their way through the jungle to the far side of the ruins and into Jervis's deployment zone. Squads Ariosto and Adorno would take up positions on the hills or the refinery complex near Pollis and Mephisto to give covering fire. My Terminators would be thrown forward mercilessly into the open plain on the right to hold up the orcish scum for as long as possible to prevent them transferring reinforcements to their threatened flank. I would place brother Captain Tycho once I had seen Jervis's deployment. Because of the missions, Jervis was forced to deploy his forces right across the table. The Death Skulls and the Bad Moons with their extra heavy weapons held the centre, with Gretchen and Evil Sons out to the right flank. A Nobs mob with a battle wagon was also in the centre, presumably as a mobile reserve. two large mobs of Goth Orcs were positioned in the jungle with an Orc Dreadnought in support. Jervis obviously understood the threat from that quarter as well as I did. The force cover in the jungle didn't seem insurmountable though, merely 2-1 odds, so I placed Brother Captain Tycho in with squads Paulus and Mephisto and stuck with my original plan. Squad Adorno deployed on the hill to squad Paulus' right and to try and pin down the Goths and Bad Moons with heavy bolter and plasma fire. Squad Ariosto was positioned on the hill behind my dreadnought to nail the Orcs' battle wagon if it moved forward to threaten squads Paulus and Adorno. Ariosto's missile launcher could also throw some frag into the forces on my right in support of the Terminators. Though there was no cover on the hill itself, I reckoned that the Orcs would have problems getting near enough to seriously threaten their position. After much deliberation, I placed the Terminators and the Rhino behind the smaller bunker on the right. The Rhino would drop off the Terminators and they would make for the rocks right beneath the guns of the Death Skulls. I felt confident that Squad Redemptor would be able to inflict crippling casualties on the Death Skulls and drive them back before the Terminators withdrew towards the left to deal with the Bad Moons. To cover myself in case, by bad luck, I didn't get the first turn, I placed squads Paulus and Mephisto in hiding in the jungle. I tried to place the other squads and the Rhino in positions where they couldn't get hit by the Orcs' heavy weapons straight away. Choosing the Orc Army by Jervis Johnson. We've been playing quite a few games of Warhammer 40,000 at the studio recently, testing the scenarios included in the new edition of the game to make sure that they are evenly balanced and exciting. They are. So when Andy asked me if I'd like to play a slightly larger game to showcase the new edition of Warhammer 40,000, I jumped at the chance. For this battle report, we decided to use two medium-sized armies of 1,500 points each, and only to use material that you get in the new Warhammer 40,000 game box. This caused me a few problems initially, because there were a few models I would normally field in my Orc army that I would not be able to use, so I would have to modify my army for this battle. For example, the rules for Ghazghal Thraka will be published in the Orcs Codex supplement, so I couldn't use him to lead my Orky horde as I normally would. Nonetheless, there was a wide selection of models I could use, so it was just a question of exactly which models I would take. Fortunately, the new Orc army list is considerably easier to use than the old lists published in Here We Go and Freebooters, so redesigning my army for this game would be a fairly easy task. Instead of having a separate list for each clan, there is one list that could be used to create any type of Orc army. On the whole, an Orc army created under the old lists will be perfectly legal using the new lists, though some of the points values have changed, generally going down rather than up. After studying the new lists for a short while, I decided that I would take a primarily infantry-based army. To a certain extent, this was forced upon me, as the only vehicles I could use were Orc battle wagons and Orc dreadnoughts, and I only have one of each in my army. This didn't worry me over much, however, as I knew that Andy's Space Marine army would be fairly small, and I felt confident that if I took a large infantry force, I could overwhelm him with sheer force of numbers. One benefit of the new lists for an Orc player concerns the cost of heavy weapons. Obviously, a las cannon will be more effective in the hands of a Space Marine than a Gretchen, and this is reflected in the new lists by reducing the cost of weapons for armies that do not have a high ballistic skill or which lack targeters. As Orc armies have neither of these, while Space Marines have both, it means that Orc heavy weapons are considerably cheaper than the equivalent Space Marine weapons. In addition, the Orcs are no longer hamstrung by malfunction cards, and so can rely on their heavy weapons and vehicles to last out the entire battle rather than breaking down on the first turn. Because of these two factors, I decided to equip my boys with as many heavy weapons as I could take. My first step picking the army was to choose its war boss and other character models. As I couldn't take Ghazghal, I took his right-hand man, Magrot, instead. This Orc war boss greatly admires Ghazghal, right down to dressing exactly like him, so I could still use my Ghazghal model. I next went on to pick the Odd Boys for the army. Odd Boys are still important with the new Orc list, as you can only take certain types of equipment if you have the appropriate Odd Boy. For example, in order to take any dreadnought, the army must include at least one pain boy. In order to take any battle wagons, it must have a mechanic, and so on. I decided to take one of each type of orc odd boy, a mechanic, a pain boy, a runt herd, and a weird boy plus his minders, so that I could use any item of equipment I wanted. Choosing the boy's mob for the army proved to be very straightforward, as I simply took every mob that I had. This gave me a 5 strong nobs mob, bristling with close combat weapons, 5 mobs of orcs, and a mob of 20 Gretchen. The orc mobs carried a total of 9 heavy weapons between them. What was more, I still had enough points left over to buy the battle wagon and the orc dreadnought I mentioned earlier. My army now had over 80 models, which I hoped would be enough to overwhelm the 30 or so space marines I expected to face. Deployment and mission cards. Because Andy had taken a couple of days off in order to recover from the effort of getting Warhammer 40,000 finished on time, I set up all of the terrain for the game, which in turn meant that Andy would get to choose which edge of the table he set up on. Because of this, it was in my own interest to set up the terrain in as balanced a manner as possible. The new Warhammer 40,000 rulebook includes extensive notes and tips on how to set up the terrain to make an exciting game, but what it boils down to is the more terrain, the better the game. Bearing this in mind, I used very nearly all of the Warhammer 40,000 terrain that we have at the studio. The result is shown on the deployment map. Note how I tried to make sure that there were adequate clumps of cover on the table so that troops could hop from one piece of cover to another to close with the enemy rather than make a suicidal charge over open ground. When Andy returned, we were ready to find out what our respective missions were and set up our armies. The new edition of Warhammer 40,000 includes a set of 4 mission cards for each side, one of which is dealt at random to each player at the start of the game. The cards describe the objectives that each player must attempt to achieve over the course of the game and the victory points he will earn if he does achieve them. Both players also receive victory points for destroying enemy models. At the end of the game, the points for any achieved objectives are added to points scored for wiping out enemy models, and the player with the most points is the winner. The mission cards are not kept secret, so you know what your opponent's mission is, which forces you to try and achieve your own victory conditions while thwarting your opponent's. For our game, I drew the Assassins as my mission, while Andy got Dawn Raid. This meant that my primary objective was to kill Andy's Space Marine Commander, while he had to try and get an undamaged vehicle or squad with less than 50% casualties into my setup zone. The combination of objectives meant that I was going to have to defend my setup zone while trying to take out Andy's commander as the Space Marines attacked. This was going to present me with a few problems, as the orcs tend to be better on the offensive rather than on the defensive. Compounding this problem was the fact I was going to have to set up first. In the new Warhammer 40,000 rules, all armies are given a strategy rating, and the army that has the lower strategy rating has to set up first. Not surprisingly, the Space Marines have a higher strategy rating than the Orcs, 5 as opposed to 3, so I would have to set up before Andy. This meant that I was going to have to defend the entire length of the table, as I could be certain that Andy would ruthlessly exploit any weak points I left. It was now up to Andy to choose which table edge he would set up on, and knowing that I would be on the defensive, he took the bottom edge of the table to deny me the benefit of the fortifications there. Studying the terrain from my half of the table, I quickly realised that Andy would want to attack through the jungle if he could, as dense terrain favours the Space Marines by denying a more numerous opponent the chance to fire with all of his troops. I therefore decided to put my main strength facing the jungle while holding the other flank with a lighter force and keeping a reserve of troops in the centre, which I could switch to either flank depending on the direction of Andy's attack. I hoped that by putting my strongest units facing the jungle, I might scare Andy into attacking across the more open terrain on the other flank. My actual deployment is shown on the deployment map. As you could see, the bulk of my troops were set facing the jungle, including the Goth mobs, the Dreadnought, and most of my characters, who excel at close combat and would be at their best in a short-range firefight in the jungle. The Death Skulls and Evil Suns, screened by the Gretchen, went on the other flank. The Death Skulls, in particular, were heavily armed, 5 out of 9 models carrying heavy weapons, and I hoped they would be able to lay down a withering hail of fire on this fairly open flank. Finally, the Bad Moons and my Nobs mob went in the centre, with the Nobs being placed in the battle wagon to act as my main reserves. Odds and ends. Although my deployment was now complete, I still had 2 tasks to carry out before the game started, so as Andy set up his army, I sat down to pick my Wargear cards and choose the psychic powers for my weird boy. Wargear cards are much like the magic item cards in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, though not nearly as powerful. The cards include all kinds of special equipment that would not normally be carried by rank and file troops, such as protective field devices and exotic weapons. Each card has a points value, and only a limited number may be taken by each character. Any embattled Orc, Squat or Imperial Guard commanders whose lives have been made a complete misery by his opponents use an unlimited number of virus grenades will be happy to learn that these weapons can now only be purchased for an army as Wargear cards, which greatly limits both their numbers and effectiveness. I hadn't actually allocated any points to Wargear cards when I picked my army, but as Andy's army came to 1522 points, while mine only came to 1490, we decided that I could spend the 32 points difference on some Wargear cards. What I really wanted from the deck was something to kill Andy's commander, and the obvious choice was a Vortex Grenade. Unfortunately, Vortex Grenades cost 50 points, which was more than I had to spend. In the end, I decided to take a combi weapon with a bolter and a melter gun for Magrot, which would give him the firepower to simply blow Andy's commander away if he could get a line of fire. I also took a haywire grenade for Durbad, my mechanic, which would prove useful if Andy included any powerful vehicles in his army. These 2 cards left me with just enough points to buy a refractor field for Magrot for a bit of extra protection and a bionic eye for my pain boy, Mad Doc Grotsnik, because it seemed appropriate. This only left picking the psychic powers for my weird boy. The new edition of Warhammer 40,000 includes a short section of rules on psychic powers, which will be expanded in future supplements, and will include special rules for all of the different types of psyker found in the Warhammer 40,000 universe. For this battle, however, I simply had to choose 2 powers for my weird boy from the list in the rulebook. One of these powers can only be used by Orc Weird Boys, the appropriately named Power Vomit, so I really had to take this. The other power I chose was Destroy Mind, which I hoped I could use to fry the brain of Andy's commander. Blood Angels Turn 1. In the new Warhammer 40,000, you use a slightly different procedure to determine who has the first turn. Each player rolls a d6 and adds their army's strategy rating to the score. Whoever gets the highest total has the first turn. Space Marines have a strategy rating of 5 against the Orcs' strategy rating of 3. I rolled a 3 against Jervis's roll of a 4 for a total of 8 against Jervis's 7, just giving me the first turn. I started off by sending the Dreadnought Furioso forward to the edge of the ruins to get a clear shot at the Orc Dreadnought. Armed with a las cannon and heavy bolter, the Orc Dreadnought posed the biggest threat to my forces on this flank, so it was imperative that I crippled it quickly. Squads Paulus and Mephisto both ran forward, somewhat impeded by the jungle, and took cover near Furioso, ready to give cover and fire if the Orcs tried to move within grenade range of my Dreadnought. After examining the potential targets for Squad Ariosto, and hardly finding any, I placed them into Overwatch to cover against the battle wagon and potentially impede the Goths' progress. The bolter-armed members of Squad Adorno took up positions on the rocky slope before them, while the heavy bolter and the heavy plasma gun ranged in on the Death Skulls and Goths respectively. Finally, the Rhino sped forward and disgorged its heavily armoured contents beneath the noses of the surprised-looking Death Skulls. Unfortunately, the Terminators could not quite make it into the cover of the rocks they were heading for and were left more than a little exposed. Furioso's multi-melter spat a roaring blast of power at the Orc Dreadnought. Caught in an expanding cloud of superheated energy, the Orc machine staggered and started to visibly melt. Rivers of molten slag ran down its hull as it stumbled back and collapsed on top of the pain boy behind it, seeming to seek a last embrace from its creator before it was destroyed. A rousing cheer went up from the advancing Space Marines. Furioso's shot, in fact, penetrated and damaged every hit location on the Ork Dreadnought. My only regret was that the thing didn't blow up and take some goffs with it. A salvo of explosive bolts from Furioso's storm bolter was less accurate, merely carving a swathe through the jungle ahead. Squad Adorno opened fire in unison with the fall of the Ork Dreadnought. The heavy plasma gunner fired on low power into Narborg's mob, engulfing the Ork's own heavy plasma gunner and another Goff in boiling plasma. Robbed of both their heavy plasma gun and their dreadnought on the left flank, the Orcs would now be hard put to even damage Furioso. After this stunning start, the Blood Angels' firing went utterly to pieces. Squad Adorno's heavy bolter missed, and the Terminators suffered a complete aberration by completely missing the Death Skulls, despite only needing two or more on a D6 to hit. They actually rolled four ones, and the one brother Marine who rolled a hit managed to jam his storm bolter. This unbelievable disaster, combined with their failure to reach the cover of the rocks, left Redemptor Squad in deep, deep trouble. Obviously, the Death Skulls' habit of painting themselves blue for luck had paid off. As an ominous epitaph to this turn, the Orc's Weird Boy tried to use his Destroy Mind power on Brother Captain Tycho. The Weird Boy failed to summon the energy required, but had a nasty premonition that he wasn't going to stop trying. Victory points, Blood Angels 2, Orcs 0. Orcs Turn 1. One of the few advantages of moving second is that it allows you to decide on your plan of action after your opponent has made his first move and committed his troops. As I suspected he would, Andy launched his attack through the jungle. Fortunately for me, although the Space Marine Dreadnought vaped my Dreadnought and took out my Pain Boy to boot, the rest of Andy's attacks were largely ineffectual and the bulk of my forces were unharmed. This meant that I still had plenty of troops to try and counter Andy's plan. I quickly decided to attempt to blow away his Terminators with massed firepower, but to hold back on the other flank against Andy's main attack. With a bit of luck, I could deal with the Terminators in a couple of turns, which would release my Death Skulls and Bad Moons to support the Goffs. To this end, I moved the Goffs and my Weird Boys so that the bulk of the boys were under cover. The Goffs simply didn't carry the heavy weapons required to enter a long-range firefight with the Space Marines, so I hoped to minimise my losses by keeping most of my troops out of harm's way until the Space Marines got closer. I made sure that the Weird Boy in particular was well hidden, as he had the added advantage of not needing a line of sight to use his psychic powers. Unfortunately, my boys' mobs were so large that I couldn't get them all behind cover and maintain squad coherency, so a few had to be left out in the open. However, the boys in the open could fire at the Space Marines and managed to pick off Squad Mephisto's missile launcher with a lucky long-range shot. The battle wagon moved up to support the Goffs, the knobs leaping out in order to attack Squad Adorno on the hill. As they did so, Squad Ariosto, which was on overwatch to guard against just such a move, opened fire with its las cannon. Fortunately for me, the shot hit a passenger rather than the vehicle itself, and then, to add insult to injury, Andy failed to kill the passenger that he had hit. The rest of Squad Ariosto's bolter fire proved equally ineffective. Having survived this wild fusillade of shots, the knobs dismounted, but no doubt still distracted by their lucky escape, failed to hit anything when they fired at Squad Adorno. Meanwhile, my other troops started to tighten the noose on Andy's Terminators. The Bad Moons closed in on one flank, the Gretchen and Evil Sun swung round the other flank, while the Death Skulls engaged them from the front. Caught in the open, the Terminators were attacked by an absolute hail of fire, being hit numerous times. However, Terminator armour has been greatly improved under the new rules and now offers a +3 saving roll on two dice rather than on a single dice as before. As all of the attacks that hit only had saving throw modifiers of -1 or -2, Andy only had to roll a 4 or 5 on 2d6 in order to make his saving roll. Not surprisingly, most of my attacks pinged off the Terminator's armour. However, the sheer number of hits meant that two attacks did get through, killing two of the Terminators before they had managed to kill any of my Orcs. As the Death Skulls broke into a rousing chorus of 2-0, 2-0, 2-0, the Weird Boy turned his Destroy Mind power on the Space Marine Commander. This time he succeeded in using the power. He needed to roll a 4+ on 1d6 in order to do so. This meant Andy had to make a leadership test for the commander. If he failed the role, the commander would be killed. Andy wasn't too worried about this, as his commander had a leadership of 10 and then promptly managed to roll an 11 on the two dice. With an agonised groan, echoed by Andy himself, the Space Marine commander fell to the ground as dead as a doornail. This meant that any Space Marines within 12 inches had to take a leadership test to see if they were shaken by the loss of their commander. Fortunately for Andy, he made all of the rolls. Nonetheless, I had achieved my objective. If I could just stop Andy achieving his objective and keep my own casualties down, then the game would be in the bag. Victory points: Blood Angels 2, Orcs 6. Blood Angels Turn 2. Things were looking very bad at the start of Turn 2. Brother Captain Tycho was down, along with two Terminators from Squad Redemptor, including the one armed with an assault cannon, and Squad Mephisto's missile launcher. Oh, why didn't I bring an apothecary? To add insult to injury, Squad Ariosto had lost its missile launcher to a catastrophic malfunction. I tried to console myself with the thought that a good turn of firing could rectify matters, trying not to think about the consequences if it didn't. I was most concerned about the Goths and Nobs flanking Squad Pollis, not to mention the battle wagon, which could do immense harm by overrunning Squads Ariosto and Adorno. To stand a chance of staying in the game, I had to get a squad or the Dreadnought into Jervis's deployment zone and earn the extra victory points I needed. This meant that the Dreadnought and Squads Pollis and Mephisto had to keep pushing forward, ignoring the threat to their flank and trying to smash Nazgut's mob directly in their path. I hoped that Squad Adorno could shoot up the Nobs by using rapid fire with their bolters. Unfortunately, Nargob's Goth mob was out of sight behind the jungle, so there was little I could do about them. Instead, I took the opportunity to move the heavy plasma gun to a different position with a better field of fire. I left Adorno's heavy bolter covering the right in case the Nobs flanked me that way, and to support the beleaguered Terminators. The Terminators were going to have to concentrate on staying alive from here on in, so Sergeant Hoon led his remaining two Terminators into the cover of the rocks, working his way to the left. The Rhino was more problematic. I could send it rampaging into the Gretchen on the far right, and it might kill a few, but it would undoubtedly be destroyed by the Evil Sun's multi-melter almost immediately. Instead, I decided to send it to the left, hoping that I could ram the battle wagon and cripple it. In the event, I couldn't actually reach the battle wagon without moving at fast speed, which meant I couldn't turn far enough to make it either. In the end, I had to compromise by moving the Rhino halfway and hoping that Jervis wouldn't be able to resist ramming me instead. After some further deliberation, I decided to place Squad Ariosto into Overwatch again to catch the Nobs and the battle wagon as they moved. If the Laz Cannon could cripple the Orc's battle wagon, I might still be in with a sniff of pushing the Rhino further forward and giving Jervis something extra to worry about. My firing started off badly again. Squad Adorno poured bolter fire into the Nob's mob and scored several hits. Only a single bolter shell hit squarely enough to wound, but ricocheted off the Nob's heavy armour. Likewise, the Rhino's twin bolters were accurate, but failed to bring down any of these super orcs. Squad Pollis scored several hits on the exposed Goth mob, but failed to wound anyone. The Terminators also had little joy, killing a single miserable Gretchen with their storm bolter fire. This debacle just goes to prove what a big difference there is between shooting up opponents with a toughness of 3 as opposed to 4. The orcs could shrug off hits, which would have dropped Elder in their tracks, so my bolter fire was getting me nowhere fast. In fact, only Squad Mephisto killed a single Goth with bolter fire during the whole of Turn 2. By this time, the battlefield was resounding with the sound of my grinding teeth and sulphurous curses at the state of my dice rolling. Dreadnought Furioso and Squad Adorno's heavy bolter rescued the situation somewhat. The heavy bolter riddled 3 bad moons, including one armed with an autocannon, and Furioso unleashed its devastating multi-melter upon Nazgut's mob, vaporising 3 of them instantly and sending the rest fleeing for their very lives, in spite of the presence of their war boss nearby. However, these events were mere bright sparks in an otherwise gloomy turn for me. I had made back some of the victory points lost when the weird boy took down brother Captain Tycho, but I was still badly lagging. By the end of the turn, I was feeling completely doomed and utterly dogged by bad luck. I fled in search of a cup of coffee to calm my ravaged nerves and hopefully give me a fresh perspective on the situation. Victory points, Blood Angels 4, Orcs 6. Orcs turn 2. Although Andy's second turn of fire inflicted fewer casualties than I could possibly have hoped for, the fact that he broke Nazgut's mob's morale was extremely annoying. I'd been hoping to attack Squad Polis with the massed fire of both Goth mobs, as you really need to fire as many Orc bolters as possible if you want to cause significant casualties, especially against tough targets like Space Marines. With half of the Goths scampering for cover, the chance of my causing much damage was severely reduced. What made this all the more galling was the fact that Margot was within 12 inches of the mob, so they only had to roll a 9 or less in order not to break. This wasn't the end of my problems either. Andy's Rhino was threatening to overrun my Goth knobs, and the Space Marine Dreadnought, which caused the casualties that routed the Goths, was going to have to be dealt with somehow. Otherwise, it would simply roll up my flank. Unfortunately, the mechanic armed with the Haywire Grenade, a highly effective weapon against Dreadnoughts, was in the battle wagon, heading in entirely the wrong direction. After a couple of minutes pondering, I finally decided to jump the mechanic out of the battle wagon so that he could run back and deal with the Dreadnought, while the battle wagon zoomed off in the other direction to ram the Rhino. This was a little bit risky as the battle wagon was going so fast that the mechanic might hurt himself as he leapt out. Fortunately, he managed it without a hitch and scampered back to join Magrat. The battle wagon roared off, smashing into the Rhino and wrecking it. The Rhino would move out of control for a turn and then grind to a halt, effectively destroyed. The battle wagon suffered only minor damage to one of its wheels, reducing it to a maximum move of 8 inches per turn for the rest of the battle, but leaving it otherwise intact. Meanwhile, Nargob's mob advanced through the jungle, firing at Squad Polis as it did so. As I had feared, however, the combination of poor Orky ballistic skill combined with the Space Marine's superior toughness resulted in the Goths failing to inflict a single casualty. The Nobs mob continued to attack Squad Adorno, peppering it with bolter shots and frag grenades. Even though I managed to inflict a number of wounds, Andy made all of his saving rolls and not a single Space Marine was killed. On the other flank, the rest of my orcs closed in on the embattled Terminators and once again unleashed a hail of fire. This time, however, the Terminators were in the cover of the rocks, which meant that most of the orcs' attacks missed. The few shots that did hit bounced off the Terminator's formidable armour. The final trick up my sleeve was for my weird boy to attack the pilot of the Space Marine Dreadnought with his Destroy Mind power. As the pilot had a leadership value of 10, I had as good a chance of killing him as the Space Marine commander. Unfortunately, my run of bad luck continued as the weird boy failed to get the power to work. All that was left to do was to try and rally Nazgut's mob, and fortunately, I did manage to pull that off. This finished off what had been a terrible turn for the orcs. The only damage I had inflicted on the Space Marines was to take out the Rhino, though at least this earned me a victory point. Unless I was very careful, the Space Marines were going to get back into the game. Victory points. Blood Angels 4, Orcs 7. Blood Angels turn 3. I was heartened somewhat by caffeine and the orcs' apparent inability to harm me in the previous turn. I put this down to the simple fact that not only did my Blood Angels have a sturdy toughness of 4, but also an excellent armour saving throw, 3 or more on a d6. Also, once the Space Marines were in cover, the orcs had tremendous problems even scoring a hit in the first place. The best example of this was the Terminators of Squad Redemptor, who had suffered about 15 hits and lost 2 of their number while in the open of turn 1. Once in the cover of the rocks, they only suffered a few hits on turn 2, all of which either failed to wound or were stopped by their tactical dreadnought armour. My move started with the wrecked Rhino careering out of control into the nearby hillside, which did at least provide Squad Adorno with some cover from the bad moons. After this, I considered what to do with Squad Redemptor. I was tempted to leave them stationary and rapid fire into the approaching tide of Gretchen or the bad moons. However, this would have achieved little in helping out my attack on the left flank and would probably have doomed the squad to losing one or two members to the Evil Sun's multi-melter during the Orc's turn. In the end, I decided to charge the Terminators at the Orc battle wagon. This may seem a bizarre move, but it would actually achieve several things. Firstly, it would take Squad Redemptor further out of the clutches of the approaching Gretchen and Evil Sons, who were obviously not going to get a look in on the battle except by killing the Terminators. Secondly, it actually moved the squad a double move towards the main area of the fighting, and thirdly, it gave them a chance to earn me an extra victory point by immobilising the battle wagon, as it had only been slightly damaged by ramming the Rhino. Time was running out for my assault force. Squads Paulus and Mephisto were unable to reach the Orc's deployment zone in time, and the Rhino was disabled. This only left the Dreadnought, and I was acutely aware of the fact that Jervis knew this too. I decided to try and blast my way forward and get the Dreadnought into a position where it could charge or run in the next turn with cover and fire from my other squads. Squad Mephisto ran forward to be in position for the next turn and try to lure out Nazgot's mob, who were lurking behind the rock spires. Furioso stamped around the corner of the ruins to spot the cowering weird boy and his minders hiding behind them. Squad Paulus advanced to close range to try and purge the Goths from the jungle on their right. Squads Adorno and Ariosto maintained their positions to give cover and fire. I directed Squad Ariosto's fire against the Nobs to try and drive them away from Adorno's position, freeing them to support Squad Paulus. However, despite having 9 shots, I only succeeded in hitting and killing 1 Nob. A feeling of dark despair swept over me. Were those Nobs blessed by Gork and Mork, or what? A further 6 bolter shots from Squad Ariosto pattered off them like summer rain, and my screams of frustration echoed out yet again. Denuded of any assistance from Squad Ariosto, Squad Paulus would be in for a good kicking from the Goths any minute now. Things picked up momentarily when Squad Ariosto's heavy plasma gunner avenged Brother Captain Tycho's death by blasting Odgit and one of his minders into tiny incandescent particles after the Dreadnought had reported their position. However, I was soon chewing the table edge with more frustration as their heavy bolter managed to roll 2 jams and junk itself for the rest of the game. Furioso was in the tricky situation of having just a single minder still before him, and beyond that, the supremely tempting target of the Orc Warboss and a large cluster of Goths. Unfortunately, the minder hadn't fled when his compatriots were vaped, as I'd hoped. Too stupid to be scared, I guess. According to the rules, I couldn't target the Goths and the Warboss instead of the minder. I tried blowing away this impediment with Furioso's Storm Bolter. It jammed. I tried using Furioso's auto-launchers on him. Only 1 frag grenade hit, and that failed to wound. Cursing vehemently, I finally blasted the annoying little git with the Dreadnought's multi-melter, and had the satisfaction of seeing him dissolve into a pile of goo. This left Squad Paulus having to deal with twice the number of Goths ensconced in a jungle completely on their own. "Doomed! Doomed!" I hear you cry. Squad Paulus's firing got off to a rousing start, with their flamer burning up 2 Goths and setting a 3rd alight. The staccato bark of the squad's bolters rose above the crackling roar as 1 Goth after another burst under the rain of explosive shells. It was as if all the bad luck that had dogged me through the game was swept away as the laws of probability snapped back into place like an overstretched rubber band. All 4 bolter-armed members of Squad Paulus slew a Goth each, breaking the mob's morale and sending Magrot and the bloodied remnants of Nargob's mob diving for cover in the jungle. Sadly, Squad Redemptor's close assault on the battle wagon yielded no reward, as I failed to immobilise it, despite one of the Brother Marines successfully damaging one of its wheels with his power fist. Jervis's rallying Nazgut's mob hiding behind the rocks had driven my victory points total right down, but breaking the other Goth mob and killing the weird boy had dragged me back up again. the vague possibility of victory moved back into view. Victory points, Blood Angels 5, Orcs 7. What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. Orc turn 3. Ouch. Well, there is no doubt about it. Andy's last turn put the Space Marines back in the game with a vengeance. By more or less destroying my second Goth mob, Andy had left me with very little to slow up his advance. The Goths I rallied last turn were simply going to have to stay where they were, so that if Andy ran into my setup zone, I would at least have some troops to engage him with in my last turn. For similar reasons, my war boss and mechanic had to remain undercover, so that if Andy advanced his dreadnought on the final turn, I would have something to attack it with. In fact, the only unit I could attack with on this flank was my Nobs mob. As their fire on previous turns had been largely ineffective, I decided to charge them into hand-to-hand combat this turn. Two of the Nobs charged Andy's Terminator Sergeant, as I only needed to inflict one more casualty to reduce the Terminators to half strength, and this would earn me a victory point. The other two Nobs headed off in the opposite direction to attack Squad Polis and hopefully slow up Andy's advance towards my setup zone. Squads that are engaged in close combat do not have to worry about the squad coherency rules, which is why the Nobs could attack in two directions at once. However, whichever group was smaller in my next turn would count as having broken morale until I got the two halves of the mob back together again. As I doubted that the Nobs would survive through Andy's turn, I didn't foresee this being a problem. The Orcs' battle wagon hurriedly backed away from the attacking Terminators, leaving room for the Nobs to attack the Terminator Sergeant. On my other flank, the Gretchen and Evil Sons chased after the Terminators, who had moved out of range again when they attacked the battle wagon. The Bad Moons carried on with their advance, while the Death Skulls stayed put and switched their attention to squads Ariosto and Adorno, which they could just see on the other side of the table. Unfortunately, the Orcs' fire proved every bit as ineffective as it had last turn, and not a single Space Marine was killed by Orc shooting. The Nobs were more effective in hand-to-hand combat, killing the Flamer Marine from Squad Polis and the Terminator Sergeant, although the Sergeant did manage to kill one of the Nobs before he went down himself. As we went into the final two turns, things were very finely balanced. Andy could still achieve his objective by running his dreadnought into my setup zone, or might even be able to inflict enough casualties to give him a win even without achieving his objective. However, I was still fairly confident. I was 3 points ahead of Andy's victory point total, so he would need to get a lot of kills to score enough victory points with casualties alone, while my war boss and mechanic were in a position to damage or destroy the Space Marine Dreadnought if it moved into my setup zone. Nonetheless, everything would rest on the outcome of Andy's final turn. Victory points. Blood Angels 5, Orcs 8. Blood Angels turn 4. With a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, I realised I couldn't get my Dreadnought into Jervis's deployment zone and score a big fat 5 victory points. The reason was that I couldn't move far enough forward with a normal move. I couldn't make a run move because of the proximity of the hidden Goths behind the rocks, nor could I make a charge against them because they were out of sight. By keeping those cursed Goths hidden, Jervis had stymied me. All I could do now was dig my heels in and try to inflict as many casualties as possible. The Bad Moons were already weakened by Squad Adorno's heavy bolter fire, so I decided to try and break them. My other targets would be the Orc War Boss and the Nobs Mob. If I could take out all these targets and not suffer too many casualties myself, I could hopefully just sneak ahead in the victory points. Squads Polis and Mephisto froze into Overwatch to cover the Nobs attacking from the right and to remain alert in case the Goths emerged from behind the rocks. An Orc mech boy was also lurking around behind the jungle, and I got a nasty impression he was trying to sidle up to the Dreadnought. Doubtless he had something to use against it up his sleeve. I decided to keep a special eye on him. My dreadnought stomped towards the smoking crater where the weird boy had been and levelled its multi-melter at the recently rallied orc warboss. The greenskin was desperately trying to hide amongst the trees, but the telltale glow of his refractor field gave him away. The two survivors of Squad Redemptor held their positions among the spiker plants and readied their storm bolters. Squads Adorno and Ariosto advanced from their hillside positions, one marine from Squad Adorno clambering up onto the exposed hill crest to get a shot at the mech boy. Furioso spat its hissing, roaring bolt of superheat for the last time, shriveling the warboss instantly and sending bright flames leaping through the edge of the jungle to kill another cowering goth nearby. A bright lance of destruction from Ariosto's las cannon blew apart a bad moon as Squad Adorno opened fire. Incandescent plasma fire vaporised another bad moon, and the brother marine on the crest of the hill plugged the mech boy with a single bolter shot. Squad Redemptor cut down yet another bad moon, and the bad moon's knob barely survived the hail of fire thanks to his heavy armour, but his continued survival prevented the surviving bad moon's breaking and running. The knob which had killed Sergeant Hune was thoroughly riddled with explosive bolts and died very messily. This left only the two knobs facing squads Paulus and Mephisto. Sadly, these didn't break, but they were still in the unenviable position of being covered by eight overwatching space marines. At the end of the turn, Squad Redemptor rallied from their shaken morale status, which would make it much harder for Jervis to dispose of them. This turn only brought me back up to level Pegan on the victory points, eight all, but if I could just kill or break those two surviving knobs and not lose any victory points myself, I could still win. Victory points, Blood Angels 8, Orcs 8. Orc turn 4. Well, the Space Marines finally showed what they could do, earning Andy 3 victory points with some very accurate shooting in his turn and evening up our scores. Even so, as I started my last turn, I knew that all I needed was one victory point to get a win. If I still had either my war boss with his combi weapon, or even better, the mechanic with his haywire grenade, then I would have had a good chance of inflicting some damage on the Space Marine Dreadnought and earning a victory point that way, but as both characters were now dead, this was not to be. This left me with a rather slim chance of finishing off the two Terminators with the massed fire of the Evil Suns and Bad Moons, combined with the equally slim chance of my two remaining knobs being able to kill three Space Marines from Squad Paulus, reducing the squad to less than half strength. Achieving either of these tasks would earn me a victory point and win me the game. Then disaster struck. Before I had even moved a single model, Andy declared that Squad Paulus would fire on my two remaining knobs. Andy had placed the squad on overwatch to provide covering fire for his dreadnought in case he didn't manage to kill my war boss and mechanic in his turn. As both were dead, there was no reason for Andy not to fire straight away, and that's exactly what he did, killing the two remaining knobs with a hail of bolter fire. Not only did this eliminate any chance of reducing Squad Paulus to half strength, but it also earned Andy another victory point, which put him in the lead. My only chance now of stopping the Space Marines winning the game was to wipe out the two remaining Terminators. I couldn't get a line of sight to enough Space Marines to reduce any of the other squads to half strength, and I didn't have a line of sight to the Dreadnought with any weapons that could harm it. Unfortunately, only my Bad Moons and Evil Suns could still see the Terminators, but they blasted away at them with every weapon they had. The Bad Moons fired first and managed to take out one of the Terminators with a lucky hit from their las cannon, which left just one last Terminator for the Suns to finish off. The Evil Suns let rip, but their multi-melter shot missed completely and their bolter fire pinged off the Terminator's awesomely thick armour. There was nobody left to shoot at the Terminators, and they had managed to pull off a win in the very last turn of the game, and almost on the very last roll of the dice. The game drew to a close with the Death Skulls blasting away at the only target they could see, the Space Marine from Squad Adorno, who had moved into the open so that he could kill my mechanic, and who now paid for his daring by being riddled with heavy bolter fire. Still, this was small consolation. Victory had been in my grasp for most of the battle, only to be torn away on the very final turn of the game. Victory points, Blood Angels 9, Orcs 8. Blood Angels Debriefing by Andy Chambers. Made it. It was a very tight game and I really did think I was doomed by the end of turn 2. Everything that could go wrong had gone wrong and I was ready to throw in the proverbial towel, which just goes to show it ain't over till it's over. However, my strategy of pushing through the jungle rather than across the plain paid off handsomely. This was because the orcs were unable to capitalise on my failures and had to come at me piecemeal because of the dense terrain. I did fail to achieve my primary objective and only pulled a minimal victory out of the bag by killing an awful lot of orcs. Jervis reckoned it was a mistake to send in the Terminators against the Orc Horde on the plain, maintaining that they would have given me the extra edge I needed to break through on the left. I think he's right. Squads Paulus and Mephisto spent too much time shooting orcs and not enough time running forward. Choosing an assault squad with or without jump packs would have made my mission an awful lot easier, but I didn't know that I would be playing a Dawn Raid mission when I chose my force. On the other hand, if I had taken an assault squad and then got Engage and Destroy instead, I would have been struggling. Though some Terminators advancing through the ruins on the left would have made my assault a lot easier, I feel that the role that Squad Redemptor performed was quite vital. If I had deployed nothing between the maw of Jervis's guns in the centre, the Bad Moons and the Death Skulls would have folded in on my right flank and destroyed Squads Adorno and Ariosto quite quickly, leaving my other squads doing a Custer's last stand in the ruins. Only Terminators could have survived in that position and remained a thorn in Jervis's side throughout the game. If I had, for example, deployed Squad Ariosto in one of the bunkers, as I did consider for a while, I guarantee that they would have been turned into dog meat by the end of turn 2. The biggest problem in trying to move forward was the presence of the Goths behind the rocks. Jervis had the good sense to realise that they could do a far better job of keeping me at bay by staying out of sight and not getting shot. As it was, I couldn't risk sending Squad Mephisto too close because the Goths would have easily wiped them out in close combat and the Dreadnought was also stymied by their presence. Of course, my Man of the Match award has to go to the Dreadnought. Without him propping up my left so comprehensively, things would have been very dire indeed. The Dreadnought was ideally suited to fighting in the close confines of the left-hand side of the table, equipped as it was with the devastating but short-ranged multi-melter. My only regret was that it didn't get into hand-to-hand combat and use its power fist. However, I do suspect its presence put Jervis off any thoughts of throwing his war boss and the Goths into hand-to-hand combat with Squad Paulus. Probably the most disappointing showing on my side was from the Devastator squad. They suffered the worst of my bad luck, but I definitely fixated too much on Squad Ariosto maintaining their position. Once their missile launcher had malfunctioned and I failed to damage the battle wagon with the las cannon, I should have moved them down to get involved with the fighting around the ruins. Squad Adorno did a fine job, though they spent far too long trying to dispose of the knobs because they could only bring bolters to bear on them. The moral of this story is not to be afraid to miss a shot with your heavy weapons so that they can move to a better position. Though it seems unthinkable at the time, your opponent will simply outmaneuver you if you stay in the same place for too long. I think placing two heavy weapons in each squad was worthwhile because there weren't enough positions to deploy all four heavy weapons together effectively. Poor brother Captain Erasmus Tycho suffered the worst luck of all, failing a 2d6 roll when all he needed to score was a 10 or less. The apothecaries assure me that with extensive psychosurgery he'll fight again, but in this game his loss was devastating. Not only did Jervis get a big fat 6 victory points, 75% of the Orcs' victory points, for taking him out, but the break test his loss caused on all the squads within 12 inches could have been disastrous. Perhaps I should have just hidden him well out of the way once I knew what Jervis's mission was, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. It just wouldn't have been heroic. Looking at Jervis's plan and deployment, I can find little fault except in positioning the Evil Sons on the extreme right. Their multi-melter would have been a lot more useful in the jungles on the left. During the game, he didn't respond quickly enough to the attack on the left, getting hung up on trying to destroy the Terminators for too long while the Goths and Nobs were gradually pummeled to death. It must be said that Jervis was exceedingly lucky to kill my commander with the Weird Boy. If he hadn't, the battle would have been an utter trouncing for him. On the other hand, I was lucky to pull it back and kill enough orcs to win in spite of failing to fulfil my primary objective. A stunning testimony to the durability of a Space Marine force at close quarters in dense terrain. The Benefits of Hindsight by Jervis Johnson. And yet again, Andy pulls off a spectacular last-minute win. Will I ever beat this man? In print, at least. Still, I'm not too upset about losing the game. After all, it was very close, and I did a lot better than the last time I led my orcs against Andy's Space Marines in White Dwarf 158. So, what went wrong? On the whole, my setup wasn't too bad, though possibly I should have placed even more troops opposite the jungle than I actually did. Certainly the Evil Sons would have been of more use in the jungle than they were on the other flank. On the other hand, if I hadn't placed the Evil Sons where I did, then Andy could have easily moved around and enveloped the open space in his Rhino, which is part of the reason why I placed the Evil Sons and their multi-melter where I did. Possibly the best compromise would have been to place the Evil Sons in the centre as part of my mobile reserve, so that they could have been switched to either flank as needed. Ah well, such are the benefits of hindsight. My other error when setting up was to leave the Orc Dreadnought in a position where Andy could get a shot at it in his first turn. I must admit that I had assumed that the jungle would block any line of sight Andy might get to the Dreadnought, but I was wrong and paid dearly for my mistake. Still, at least the battle taught me that the new rules for setting up mean that you must be extra careful when you have to set up first, as a cunning opponent will punish any mistakes that you make. During the game, my biggest error was committing too many of my troops to trying to wipe out the Terminators. In particular, I really should have moved the Bad Moons over to defend against the main Space Marine attack through the jungle, rather than using them against the Terminators. This mistake was compounded by my zooming the Nobs mob forward in the battle wagon on the first turn. It was only bad luck on Andy's part that stopped the Nobs being wiped out on the first or second turn. As most of them were armed with power fists, they could have even damaged Andy's Dreadnought in close combat, which might have won me the game. And last but not least, advancing the Goth mob through the jungle to engage Squad Paulus on turn 2 probably wasn't that good an idea either. My boys didn't manage to kill a single Space Marine and were all but wiped out by the return fire, earning Andy 2 victory points and leaving me with almost no troops to defend against his main attack. If I had thought about it a bit harder at the time, I probably wouldn't have made the move because the other Goth mob had already been driven off and I should have realised that 10 orcs are going to get badly mauled by an equal number of Space Marines. But I had decided on my plan of action during my first turn rather than revisiting it in the face of the situation I faced at the start of turn 2. I carried on blindly with my plan without thinking it through. Still, it wasn't all bad news. I was more than pleased with the performance of my Weird Boy and keeping him well hidden for as long as possible so that he could attack without suffering any return fire proved very successful. I'll remember that tactic in any future games. I learned my lesson on turn 2 and kept my other Goth mob well under cover where they acted as a threat to Andy's troops and stopped him getting any troops into my deployment zone. It just goes to show that you don't have to bring any guns to bear to have an effect on a battle. Turning my attention to the Space Marines tactics, there are only a couple of points I would make. Although Andy disagrees, I feel that using the Terminators to try to hold up my troops on the left flank was a bad move and nearly resulted in their being wiped out. The job could have been done just as well by one of the Space Marine Devastator squads, and I'm sure that the Terminators would have proved a lot more effective in the jungle terrain on my right flank than out in the open facing the massed fire of almost half the Orc army. Andy's other mistake was letting my Weird Boy get in range of his commander, and right from the very first turn as well. My Weird Boy had almost a 10% chance of killing the commander each and every time he attacked, And while odds like that aren't all that good, they quickly add up over the course of a few turns. As it was, I lucked out and killed the commander very early on, and the victory points I earned almost gave me the game. Almost. But turning aside from the game-winning tactics and feeble excuses, I do feel that this game served to highlight the benefits of some of the changes Andy and Rick have made in the Warhammer 40,000 game system. The actual game mechanics have been streamlined to make Warhammer 40,000 battles faster and more enjoyable. The new Wargear cards are also worth a mention, and the new army lists are both easier to use and much more evenly balanced than they were before. But probably the most important changes of all are the new mission cards and victory conditions, which serve to give a sense of purpose to each game and greatly add to the excitement level of any battle. All in all then, the new rules make for a faster, more even and more exciting game, and you can't ask for much more than that. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.